everything out closer to the people.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble.
An oppressed person will fight back.
2-4-5
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
This is Radio Basics. I am one of your hosts for tonight, Steve.
Greetings, Toronto. My name is Makaya. Welcome. We are here tonight, Monday night, as always, Radio Basics.
8 to 9 p.m. Bringing you the most important international, local, national news for the people. We got a big show ahead of us tonight. We're going to be talking about the ongoing slaughter by Israel being carried out in Gaza. We're going to be talking about the uprisings in Oakland in response to the murder of innocent Oscar Grant by Bay Area Rapid Transit Police. And we're also going to be talking about a couple strikes in Toronto. 3903, as you know, going to be taking that over in the middle part of our show. And we're also going to be talking about a local strike going on here in Toronto that I'm sure a few have heard about so far.
And as always, we got some big tunes for you, big political tunes for you.
So without further ado, carrying it over into the local part of our show and local news this week. Workers of the Corex Soap Factory, located at the foot of the Don Valley Parkway, continue their seven-month-long strike against the exploitative and precarious labor conditions that their employer has been trying to impose on them. On June 2, 2008, 110 workers of the factory went on strike against their employer, the Pensler Capital Corporation. In an interview with Basics, the union's chief steward, Bill McLaughlin, said the management wanted to do away with the collective agreement. They wanted to make us into part-time workers with no job security. They cut wages, they cut security benefits, and the right to grieve. Since the strike began, only three workers have crossed the picket lines to work under the new conditions. The remaining 107 workers have held the picket line for 24 hours a day now for 7 months, even on Christmas Day and New Year's. The workers reported to Basics that their morale was high and they were going to hold out until they attained their modest demands of maintaining the status quo. Meanwhile, safety issues are being raised by community members and the union members concerning the operating of the factory by improperly trained scabs. One worker on the picket lines has said, Angus Mortson, he told Basics that if the place goes, it takes the whole block with it. One thing that one would think that after the massive explosion at the propane storage facility in North Toronto this past August 2008, elected officials at all levels would be a little more proactive, ensuring that corporations are taking proper measures to ensure safe operating conditions for workers and communities that surround them. But I guess that's too much to ask, is it not, Makaya?
I guess so. Seems ridiculous, but you know how the world's working these days.
For real, it seems like these corporations can just have free rein and do whatever they want.
Oh, yes.
That's why workers are fighting back.
So taking us to international news, our first segment of the international news. After 17 days, Israel is showing no sign of letting up its terroristic assault on the Palestinians of Gaza. Since Israel began its illegal campaign of aerially bombarding Gaza, over 4,000 Palestinians have been injured, almost 1,000 killed, and some 25,000 left homeless or displaced. That is crazy. To get a sense of the scale of the terror being inflicted on the Gazans, we can note that these casualties are quickly approaching the 1,110 killed and the 4,500 injured in Israel's 33-day war on Lebanon in the summer of 2006.
That was a four, almost five-week conflict, and this is, in just a couple weeks, the scale of horror is already reaching that level.
Ridiculous. By comparison, though, the rockets of Hamas, which have been offered up as the sole pretext for Israel's invasion, have killed three Israeli civilians. Three, compared to the 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier today, the UN Human Rights Council passed a resolution condemning Israel's criminal assault. However, every single EU member nation of the 47 member council abstained from the vote. Meanwhile, the Canadian government was the only member of the council to vote against the resolution condemning Israel.
Yay, Canada!
we're so proud to be Canadian.
Us peace-living country that we live
in. I know, don't be fooled. And if anybody, any of my people from Brooklyn are listening right now, or people from New York are listening, don't be fooled. Canada is not a peace-loving nation, as you may think.
Public service notice. Canadians should no longer wear the Canadian flag as they're touring the world.
I know, for real.
You may face attacks by angry, oppressed people.
For real. But so far, the greatest act of diplomatic solidarity for the Palestinians has come from the government of Venezuela. No surprise. On January 6th, the anti-imperialist Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and Venezuela's foreign ministry decided to expel the Israeli ambassador and part of the embassy staff. Yeah, Chavez.
Venezuela holding it down.
For its part, the Canadian government was the sole government to vote against today's UN resolution condemning Israel, which passed by a margin of 33-1 with 13 abstentions. While the Canadian government and Stephen Harper have remained mostly silent over the course of Israel's barbaric assault, today's vote shows just how strongly the Canadian government is in its support for Israel's genocidal policies against the Palestinians. That is unconditional support for Israel's genocide against the Palestinians. Last week, Thornhill's Member of Parliament, Peter Kent, the former Global Television reporter and current junior foreign affairs minister for the Canadian government, said that Hamas bears a terrible responsibility for this and for the wider deepening humanitarian tragedy. Kent's comments reflect the conservative government's long-standing support for Israeli war crimes, paralleling Stephen Harper's comments in 2006, which referred to Israel's war in Lebanon as a measured response to Hezbollah. Okay, Stephen Harper. But meanwhile in Toronto, thousands of Canadians rallied once again over the weekend at the Israeli consulate on Bloor Street, demanding an end to Israel's illegal occupation, bombardment, and invasion of Gaza. Every city in Canada has seen major demonstrations in favor of the Palestinians over the last few weeks, with the Toronto demonstration on Saturday, January 3rd, reaching over 10,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
It is believed to be one of the largest anti-war demonstrations in Toronto since the beginning of the Iraq War in 2006.
For real, that was a big demo.
And we were both there, and other than the frigid weather,
mm-hmm.
I think it was a very successful rally. A lot of support, a lot of support out there.
That was the rally that happened this last Saturday,
mm-hmm.
the one outside the Israeli consulate.
Yes.
The week before, the one at which there was over 10,000 people,
mm-hmm.
Then marched to the American consulate, if I'm not mistaken. I wasn't at that one.
Okay.
But yeah, that was one of the most successful rallies in Toronto in years, half a decade at least.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes to show the scale of outrage that is currently, you know, being, you know, like that's developing amongst people here in Toronto.
Right, and this I noticed this past weekend, you know, there was, like I said, a lot of people. I know they were expecting about 15,000. I don't know if they reached those numbers,
mm-hmm.
but I noticed the 5 or 6 at most pro-Israel supporters. I don't know if you saw them with their flags there.
Yeah.
And
the 500 cops around them?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, as always, the police lines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I believe a couple days before, there was a pro-Israel rally at a synagogue up on Bathurst, if I'm not mistaken, at which I saw the National Post. There was some 4,000 people there. So, you know, there are clearly people who are supporting Israel right now. It's unfortunate, given the massive onslaught that Israel is carrying out against the Palestinians. I know there's a lot of disinformation around what's happening with this conflict and who really is to blame.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Canadian government, as you mentioned, Peter Kent.
Yeah.
He's a Thornhill,
Thornhill member of parliament.
He claimed that Hamas bears complete responsibility for the conflict,
which is ridiculous.
But yeah, I remember this is occupied territory, people. For all those listening,
you know, it just hurts me, because even like beyond the politics of it all and whether or not you support Israel or support Palestine, like we just need to look at the human cost in all of this, you know, and that's what people fail to recognize. Like, we're talking about thousands have been displaced, 25,000 have been displaced. You know, thousands have been killed, and it's just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
People.
Moving on, what do we got next?
Do we have commercials?
I guess we should go to a commercial.
Yeah, we got some commercials.
We got to
pay some bills for CHRY Community Radio 105.5.
Mind you, these are not corporate commercials. These are
local
community
businesses.
Announcements.
We support them, of course.
For real. Radio Basics. We'll be back.
Was a track by Suher Hamad with DJ K Salam off of K Salam's album The World Is Ours. Suher Hamad herself is Palestinian. She's a Palestinian spoken word poet out of Brooklyn. I believe her parents are Palestinian refugees.
Mm-hmm. And another local news taking you now to the strike of QP3903 as QP3903 enters its ninth week of its strike against York University with 50,000 students and many others demanding answers as to why the strike has not been brought to a resolution as of yet. Negotiations began in earnest just over a week ago, and after York University made its offer, its first and last offer on January 7th, since the commencement of the strike last year, York University is now forcing the union membership to ratify their offer and has asked the Ontario Ministry of Labour to convene a forced ratification vote this coming Friday, January 9th. Forced ratification is a government-supervised vote process that permits employers to contact striking members of QP3903 directly and compel them to vote on a deal of the employer's own choosing, regardless of gains made by the bargaining team. This loophole in labor law was introduced by our favorite, Mike Harris, conservative government in the 1990s here in Ontario, as a means for employers to circumvent the bargaining process. While the union has no equivalent tool, the limitation on the employer is that they can only take this step once. Over the course of the strike, the mainstream media has demonstrated a staunchly anti-strike bias, providing disproportionate coverage to the small rallies of anti-strike undergraduates and York University's positions and arguments about the strike, yet little to no coverage about the widespread support across the labor movement and other community organizations here in Toronto for QP3903's struggle. And so this is why Radio Basics today is bringing to you a live discussion and phone-in session with a QP3903 representative so that you can have your questions answered. So please, listeners, you're encouraged to call in once we get the discussion started and ask any questions they have about the strike. And the number in our studio is 416-736-5656. That's 416-736-5656. Please call in. On the line with us today is QP3903 spokesperson Tyler Shipley. Welcome to Radio Basics, Tyler.
Hey, thanks, Steve. It's nice to be in a friendly alternative radio
for real. And I mean, yeah, we are friendly. We're down for community power. We're down for all power to the people. And we brought you here tonight to really, you know, let's ask its tough questions. What's really up with the strike? Perhaps you can give us a bit of background on what QP3903 has been fighting for.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think there was, I mean, we went into this in July with a really broad set of demands, some of which were about the very specific working conditions that our members face, and others that were much more broad and political. So, you know, things ranged from very specific proposals around childcare needs for our members, but ranged as far also as proposals to eliminate the student code of conduct, which was obviously a much more political proposal. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's, you know, dwindled away to the point where we're now fighting for a few key issues. And I think the one that I would highlight in particular is in regards to job security for contract faculty. And not just job security for people who are doing contract professor work, but also conversion from contract work into full-time tenured professor positions. Mm-hmm. I mean, the long and the short of it is, you know, in the last 30 years, we've seen a massive movement under the so-called neoliberal universities away from hiring tenured professors and into hiring contract professors. So, mm-hmm. I mean, this originated as something, you know, contract professors were used in the occasional case where, you know, oh, shit, we don't have anyone to teach mathematics 1,000. Okay, here's somebody that has the qualifications. Let's just hire them temporarily to cover this course for this 1 year. But what happened was that was obviously a cash cow, and so universities have moved towards that model so that now 70% of new hires in universities in Canada are hired as contract professors instead of tenured professors.
Mm-hmm.
So with that kind of background, I'll just kind of outline what we were asking for. We were asking specifically for some form of job security for some people who've been contract teaching for like 10, 15, sometimes 20 years. And at the same time, protection of the program that converts people from the contract professor stream into full-time tenured positions.
Mm-hmm. That's it's interesting that you point out this problem with contract faculty and the casualization of work. Earlier in our show today, we were talking about an ongoing strike that has been going on down by the Don Valley Parkway of soap workers at the Corex factory. They've been going on; their strike has been going on for 7 months now, and one of the main reasons they went on strike is because the employer was trying to transform their full-time jobs with benefits into part-time jobs without benefits. So basically completely eliminating the full-time workforce and replacing them with part-time, more exploitable casual labor. And another interesting thing to note, so that, I mean, we can draw out the analogies to the broader labor movement, is that, you know, over the last 2 months, 140,000 full-time jobs were lost from the Canadian economy. However, overall in 2008, the number of jobs in Ontario, in Canada slightly increased, but all the full-time job losses were made up with part-time jobs that were replacing those full-time jobs. So this is exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and this is a trend, as you say, that affects, like, you know, every sector across the board. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's a very clear trend in Western capitalism at this moment. You know, because I think in a way the gains that the labor movement made, whether you know, see them as gains or not, the small victories of the 60s and 70s and the creation of the welfare state and the strength that unions had, you know, at least comparatively speaking at that time, you know, it was, in some senses, a victory for working people. And in the last 30 years, we've seen, you know, this massive sort of attempt to erode that and break that down. And one of the ways that always happens is in, like you say, eliminating full-time positions and replacing them with part-time work. And in the context of higher education, I mean, you know, I keep trying to explain this, you know, to folks in the mainstream media that, you know, I mean, you're taking, something as important as university teaching, and you know, we hear all the time about how, oh, you know, students, they're our future. You know, this is, you know, this sort of age-old thing about, you know, our future workers and so on. Well, I mean, okay, you know, if we take that to be the case, then why are we treating university teaching as if it were some sort of disposable position that anyone, you know, any Yahoo can kind of waltz in and do? Mm-hmm. And so people who are, like, really intensely fully qualified, you know, professors who have been teaching for 20 years are still being treated as if they were, you know, temporary employees. And go ahead. Yeah, no, go ahead.
So that's the situation of contract faculty. Now, let's talk about some of the other units. My understanding is that there's two other units in the union, right? Unit 1 and Unit 3?
Right. So, yes. I mean, Unit 1 and 3 are similar. In Unit 1 are teaching assistants, and Unit 3 are graduate assistants who do usually research or like clerical work for professors. Nothing glamorous, I can assure you. Mm-hmm. And, of course, teaching assistants are folks who actually are responsible for teaching tutorials. So the main issue here is it's a fairly simple one. It comes down to overall funding for graduate students. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about wages in the mainstream media because that's something that they want to grab and use because it seems simple. And because if you talk in terms of wages, you can vilify someone for asking for a wage they think is too high. But what we're actually looking for here, wages are something we've been clear we're flexible on. We're asking for guaranteed levels of funding so that graduate students, no matter who they are or what their circumstances when they enter graduate work, have a little bit better chance of surviving grad school. Insofar as, like, we looked at numbers that came out. They're a bit out of date. They're from about 2005. Mm-hmm. But attrition rates, so the number of people who start PhD or master's programs but aren't able to finish, usually mm-hmm. because it's too expensive. And the numbers range from 25 to 50%.
Wow.
I mean, it's just staggering to think of how many people then. I mean, if you know, I don't even know how many, you know, grad students there are in Ontario, but if you imagine 50% of the people who enter PhD programs in the humanities and social sciences, you know, get in 2 or 3 years, that's, you know, God knows how much tuition and related ancillary costs, and don't even come out of it with anything. So, you know, I mean, the universities are happy to take our tuition for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and for those of us that just can't survive, who just can't make ends meet for that long under such difficult conditions, you know, eventually drop out and get nothing out of the deal. And, you know, again, this is, I mean, I think this is something we have to take really seriously. I mean, in the context of, you know, of this being higher education, this being one of the main sort of areas in which, you know, there's a possibility for really building, you know, sort of, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to say social movements because students are not necessarily always the most progressive groups, but certainly there is something valuable in building up a really sort of well-educated population in terms of, especially in terms of things like humanities and social sciences, where people learn to think critically.
And especially allowing that education to be accessible to all. Because
exactly.
if people are not guaranteed a certain minimum level of funding, the only ones who are going to be able to study are those who are either have to go back and live with their parents, if they even have that option, or people who already have money to begin with, right?
Exactly. That's exactly it. And that's why, you know, although, you know, it gets mocked fairly often in media, that's why we keep saying, look, a lot of what we're doing here is about the quality and accessibility of education. Because, you know, at a certain point when education and higher education is something that is only available to those who have the means to afford it, it starts to really, really lose its critical potential. You know, not only that, it's also just, like, you know, morally and ethically fucked up.
Sorry, you really have to watch your language.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Apologize on the air. I have to.
Sorry, Steve.
Yeah, no problem. Apologize to our listeners. But just to remind our listeners, we are talking to Tyler Shipley. This is Radio Basics on CHRY 105.5. He is from QP3903, and we'd like you to call in. You know, there's been a lot of disinformation in the media about what's been happening with the strike, QP3903, what's going on at York University. People are rightly upset. 50,000 students have lost 2 months' worth of education, and we're here to talk with the union. We're here to talk with Tyler about what's really happening, why they're on strike, and how this thing is going to be settled, please call us 416-736-5656. That's 416-736-5656. Tyler, so let's continue with the conversation here. So how has the negotiations been going so far?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, right? I mean, we were in bargaining for about 4 months before the strike started. And in that time, I think it was pretty clear to everyone involved that the university was stonewalling us. They had no intention of bargaining meaningfully with us. And in fact, over the course of those 4 months, we never really saw any significant movement from them on anything. I mean, we would simply go to the table and say, what do you think of this? And they would say no. And we would say, okay, what do you think of this? And they would say no. And this went on for about 4 months and ultimately ended in pushing us into a strike situation. Even when the strike started, for the first 2 months or so of the strike, we revised, you know, repackaged, reformatted, and often reduced our proposals three times significantly in an effort to try to restart the talks. And we didn't see that same movement from the university.
Now, my understanding is that that's not negotiating.
There is a legal term called bargaining in bad faith, and you know there were moments where I really felt like they were towing that line very carefully. I mean, you have to go to the bargaining table with an intent to truly negotiate, and that was not what we saw. That changed about a week ago, a little bit over a week ago now. There were 5 days between about January 3rd and 7th or so, and in those 5 days, for once, for the first time during the strike, we really felt like there was some movement. Negotiation actually started to happen, and some of our key priorities, we started actually working towards a settlement on some of them. And I think there was a lot of hope that that would sort of be the beginning of the end of the strike. Unfortunately, as you know, as that process was just starting to take hold, the university decided to walk away from the table and force a ratification on an offer that, as far as we're concerned, is premature. I mean, there were some movements made, but on a lot of the key issues, we're just not there yet. And for them to force us to vote on something that, you know, we've all indicated is really inadequate, I mean, it's such a waste of everyone's time.
Now, may I ask, are the details of what has been negotiated so far public information?
They are, yeah.
Okay. So
it's up on York's website.
Okay, so I want to talk about one of these, because it seems like this is not negotiations. This is like what they're asking the union to do is actually provide major concessions on points that are even worse than the 2005 collective agreement, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right, yeah. And I mean, I think on one of those, and I would go back to the issue of contract faculty, because I think this is a really important one. On a per year basis, for the last 20 years or so, we have usually seen an average of about 5 to 8 people who are contract professors converted into tenure stream, which is not to say that they get some sort of automatic conversion. You still have to go through all the usual processes in order to get tenure. But we're usually guaranteed between 5 and 8 people moved over per year. What the university has offered in this contract is 2 conversions this year, 2 next year, and 1 in the third year, which is obviously a concession, but it's made even worse by the fact that in December alone, there were over 100 people retired from tenure stream positions.
At York University?
At York University.
100 tenured professors retired.
That's right. So, okay. I mean, we were talking earlier about this casualization, and I mean, what they're really doing in this sort of clawback of our conversions is they're really institutionalizing casual labor in teaching, because, I mean, those other, let's say it was 100, it was more than 100, but let's say it was 100 people who retired, and they're offering us 5 conversions in the next 3 years. What's happening to those other 97 positions?
Contract.
Exactly.
I guess a lot of them would be contract, would they not?
Exactly. That's what'll happen. You know, it'll probably be more than 97 people get hired, and they'll all get hired, you know, on a piecemeal basis to do some part of that teaching. You know, and so it'll continue to sort of deepen that kind of structural relationship of people teaching in that contract professor stream.
Just to do some calculus here for our listeners, I mean, if York University loses 100 professors because they're retiring, there's only so many professors they can filch from other universities, and ultimately, if there's not, those tenure streams are not being replaced, then contract faculty is going to have to pick up the remainder, right?
That's right. And actually, at this moment, York University doesn't have the option of bringing professors over from other places. There is a hiring freeze right now at York University, which means that they can only move people into tenure stream from our Unit 2 contract faculty group. So they really are eliminating, at least in this one example, at least 97 tenured professorship positions, which, I mean, say what you want about tenure. It is one of the hallmarks of academic freedom at the university level, because it's one of the only ways that academics have ever been able to protect themselves when doing really critical research and critical work.
So this is also an attack on academic freedom.
Because exactly.
My understanding, I mean, I've gone through the university system. I did an undergraduate degree. I'm currently in a master's degree. My experience with professors who didn't have tenure was that they knew they were being watched, and they couldn't say what they wanted to say. They couldn't publish what they wanted to publish because they were worried about getting on that tenure stream.
Exactly. And not only that, so you know, they can't publish what they want to publish. And in often cases, they don't have time to publish anything, even if they wanted to, because the conditions that these people work under are that they're paid a lump sum per course, which at York University is around $14,000, which, you know, may sound like a lot off the top, but I mean, if you imagine trying to scrape together a living, pay off a mortgage, you know, maybe raise some children, have a reasonable life, you know, you're talking about having to teach four or five courses just to get by. And for people who are not terribly familiar with, you know, the sort of the time and energy it takes to teach a course, most tenured professors teach about two per year. And that's, you know, and that's considered a fairly healthy course load.
Yeah.
To teach four or five is insane. It often has to be done at different universities. So
yeah.
There's people, you know, friends of mine who teach at York, but they also teach at Laurier, they teach at Waterloo. You know, on
I know
Friday,
some of these people, they're a wreck.
Yeah, exactly.
They can't have a family. It's impossible for them to live.
Exactly. And so, you know, if they can't even barely make ends meet, how can they be expected to do the research and get the publications that would then be put on their resume in order to get them into a better teaching experience?
Which permanently stratifies that section of the labor force, right? Because then these people remain on the bottom indefinitely.
Precisely. Exactly. That's exactly it. And so it just, you know, it becomes a self-perpetuating thing where, you know, once you get filtered into that contract professor stream, which most of us, you know, I'm a PhD student, I will likely get filtered into that because that's, as I said, they're eliminating those tenure positions. You get into that contract work and you're stuck there and there's nowhere to go. And that's why we have people in our union who are, you know, who have 20, 25 years of experience teaching and all of it on, you know, in these contract positions.
So let's talk for, we only have a couple minutes left, Tyler. Once again, if anybody wants to call in and talk, ask any questions from this QP3903 representative, Tyler Shipley, you can call us, 416-736-5656. We'll have the lines open for another 2 minutes. Just to wrap up, Tyler, so my understanding is the position of the official position of the bargaining team, the executive right now, is that they're against the forced ratification vote and that the membership should mobilize against it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. As you said at the top, this is a loophole in labor law that Mike Harris introduced. And not only do we have a problem with the offer as it stands, we also have a problem with the way that we've been coerced into voting on this offer. We actually brought this exact same offer to our membership meeting on Thursday night. There were over 500 people there. We put it to them, we explained what was on the table, and we held a vote on whether or not we should send this back and send the bargaining team back to the table to reject it and say to the university, you need to come up with something better. 90% of the people in that meeting said this is not adequate. And yet this is the same offer that York has put forward for our entire membership to ratify. So given that it is a concessionary offer, we're wholeheartedly encouraging our members to say no to this forced ratification vote. We are confident that they will, because I think our members know that we've been on strike for over 2 months. And we've put so much of ourselves and sacrificed so much in this process that to accept something that is not significantly different from what was on the table when we went on strike, you know, would be an absolute folly. And the good news, I think, the upshot of all of this, you know, and especially if there's any folks in the union who are out there listening, the good news, if there is any, is that once we defeat this forced ratification, the university has used their last dirty trick. This is the last sort of, you know, tactic that they have up their sleeve. And
do you think back to work legislation might be an issue?
Well, I mean, that is another kettle of fish entirely, and you know, you can never count it out. I mean, it would be historically unprecedented. The labor movement in this city and province would go nuts. I mean, it would, because I mean, if our union were legislated back to work, that would essentially be saying that, you know, in this day and age, if you're a public sector employee, you don't have the right to go on strike, because, you know, if you hold out and the strike goes on too long and the employer doesn't capitulate, you will be forced back to work. Mm-hmm. So,
well, Tyler, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. Sure. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks so much for having me.
Good luck.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Radio Basics, we're going to a commercial. We'll be right back.
Right there, Progress Negus with his track Free. I heard a rumor that a certain Basics member might have done the backups on that track.
What? Who's that?
I don't know. I don't know who it is. I don't know. But Progress Negus, though. Big, big, big Toronto reggae artist. Much love to Progress if you're listening out there. Now, I did the first international news section at the beginning of the show, so we got a little bit more international news. We're going to go down to the U.S. for this one.
Wrap it up.
Last week, youth in Oakland lit the skies afire with riots and protests in response to the New Year's Eve execution of a young black male by the Bay Area Rapid Transit Police in Oakland, California. The cell phone video recording of the execution of the 24-year-old Oscar Grant has been widely circulated on the internet and shows the transit police shooting Grant while he lay on the ground, belly down and back up. And that sounds all too familiar, doesn't it? The conflict began when the BART police halted the train because of reports of a fight. Oscar Grant was not one of the detained, not initially, but in attempt to defuse the situation, Grant was also detained and forced to the ground by the Bay Area Rapid Transit Police, minutes later being shot in the back for no reason. The cell phone video, which shows that the situation was clearly under control, led to uprisings across Oakland as youth and other community forces mobilized, demonstrated, and in some cases, rioted. Over 100 people were arrested in the uprising that followed a week after Grant's execution. If you're interested in seeing the video, which I recommend you see the video, you can view it on our website, the Basics Community Newsletter website, at basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com.
Yo, this video is so outrageous. Like, people just got to see it. Like, you can't even see it coming. Like, there's people, they're arrested, they're handcuffed, they're on the floor. And then suddenly this cop pulls out a gun and shoots this young man in the back. He was on the floor.
And that's why I'm saying it's all too familiar, because how many times have we heard the same story, just different city,
Jeffrey
different Ryotica, names. Amadou Diallo.
Aloui El Nadir.
Sean Bell. You know, it could go
Freddy
on.
Freddy Villanueva.
It could go on, you know, and go on.
Alexei Grigoropoulos in Greek, which led to massive uprisings a week long. Mm-hmm. I mean, sorry, like over a month long, all throughout the holiday season, like right until the new year, then the uprisings are continuing. Like, you were clearly fed up with police terrorism. It's got to stop, and if it ain't going to stop, this is what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a good thing that they rioted in Oakland. I think it's a good thing for sure. But we got to wrap the show up. We got to wrap the show up in a couple minutes.
Do we have any outgoing announcements?
I think we do. I think we got something going on Friday.
That's a rhetorical question. I really know what's up, right? Like, Basics is launching the 12th issue of their newspaper. We've been around for 2.5 years.
Big up, Basics.
And we got a big issue coming up. We are going to be launching the paper at Toronto Woman's Bookstore, which is located at Harvard and Spadina, just a little bit west of Spadina on the south side of Harvard. It's going to be from 7 to 9 p.m. The details are going to be up on our website and in the next few hours. People should check that out, basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com. We're going to have some discussions about what's in the paper and things going on in our community. We're going to have some performances, some guest performances, some new Wasan with some guest performers who will be performing with him. And yeah, of course, the launch of our paper. Come up, pick up our paper. It's free. Distribute it in your community. If you want to develop a long-term relationship with Basics, we can discuss how we can get you the paper and how we can finance it and how we can get it into your community. But Basics is free. We deliver it door-to-door in communities all across Toronto. Look for it soon, coming to a community near you. Jane and Finch, watch out. It's coming soon.
It's coming. We're already in Regent. We're already in Lawrence Heights.
We're in PO. We're in Pelham. We're in Esplanade.
It's only a matter of time before we're all over the city and worldwide.
Media for the people, worldwide. Apparently, we're going down into New York soon.
Yeah, I heard something about
that.
I heard something about
that. We're working on Ottawa, Montreal.
Yeah, you
know. I mean, the voice of the people spreading, unstoppable.
No doubt. But you can hit us up. Anybody who wants to hit us up, comments, complaints, criticisms. You want to send us respect. Check us out at radiobasics@gmail.com. Please, we love to hear from the people because that is who we do this for.
We want you to get involved. We want you to become future hosts of our radio show. Yeah. We want you to direct us to news stories and analysis that you think we should be talking about. We want you to join Basics. We want you to bring the newspaper into your community. This is how the voice of the people is going to spread. And we have to take control of local media for ourselves, build local media, because clearly, just look at what's happening in Gaza right now. Mm-hmm. Like, it's completely, not only is it completely a one-sided offensive, it's mm-hmm. the coverage is completely one-sided.
Of course.
Canada has been staunchly in support of this barbaric assault on the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And what are we hearing in the media? That Hamas is to blame.
Right, of course.
Just like they did in 2006 with Lebanon.
And that, actually, I have a little joke to tell. You know, it might not be funny to people who are not activists, but at the rally this past Saturday, it's just
I take offense to the term activist. But,
I'm sorry.
Whatever. You know, I'm a lifetime community organizer.
Right, politically involved people. People, you know, some people are not politically involved. You know,
this is true.
But my anecdote at the rally on Saturday, there was barriers. Obviously, everybody knows there's barriers. It was freezing outside, what, like minus 12 or something like that.
My toes were cold.
I know. I just needed to get a tea. I just needed something hot in my system. So I was trying to get to the second cup, which is right beside the Israeli consulate, right? Yeah. And the police officer told me that, no, it's closed. It's closed. You can't go in there, which I knew was a lie because you and some other of my friends had just, got second cup. And what the police officer told me is, no, they shut down because of the rally. Anybody at the rally has to go buy their coffee from Starbucks. And I was like,
"What an
oh
insult.
My gosh. I'm
Doesn't
like,
Starbucks have Starbucks locations
Israel.
In occupied territories?
Starbucks supports Israel along with Chapters and Indigo and all that because they're all connected. And this police officer, I'm clearly there wearing a Palestinian scarf. Obviously, he knows who I'm supporting. He's telling me to go to Starbucks and support the other people.
I wonder if Second Cup, I really doubt that Second Cup told the police to direct their customers towards Starbucks.
No, I think that the police officer was just being a little bit of a hater.
No, whatever, man. This monopoly capitalist, that monopoly capitalist. It really doesn't matter. We should have just brought our own coffee. Do for self, right? Why didn't we think about that? Basics. We could have sold coffee for like 50 cents. Could you imagine?
But that's what we're doing here at Radio Basics. We're doing for ourselves. We're doing for the people. So please, please hit us up at radiobasics@gmail.com.
And check out the Launch People Toronto Women's Bookstore Friday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Basics number 12 is going to be a huge issue. We're covering the Oakland riots. We're covering the Cuban Revolution at 50 years. We're covering the one-sided massacre of Gaza. We're covering the local strike that's been going on at the Corex factory at the Don Valley Parkway. We're covering Jane and Finch rallying against police brutality, the QP3903 strike, the Barrier Lake blockades of the Algonquins. We're covering everything, like in the international section, the struggles of the Filipinos to the oppression of Tamils in Sri Lanka, and lots of other local events and local community organizing. So please check it out. You can find us online at Basics Community Newsletter, basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com, and check us out on Friday night. Micaiah, you have anything else for us?
I just want to thank everybody who are here each and every Monday from 8 to 9 p.m. on CHRY 105.5.
And I want to thank that listener who called in during the piece that we were doing on,
yes,
on the bombing
of
Gaza.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. You called in. You reminded us. You reminded me that Israel is an illegal, like it's illegally occupying the territories. You reminded us that, what else did he say? He said that some incredible stuff. Yeah, I wish I could have had time to put you on the air, but mm-hmm. I didn't have a chance, brother. Maybe we're going to have a live discussion on this issue on Radio Basics,
right?
Because of the situation in Gaza is getting worse and worse day by day.
I can see that being a heated discussion.
I'd like to thank all our listeners. We got a track going on.
We got one track to go out. It's from Stickman's solo album called Manhood, and we love the Dead Prez here. Of course, we love the Dead Prez, but the problem is that most of the Dead Prez songs have swearing, so. This tune, it's on his album, but it's actually featuring a female. It's not his most political tune, but there's no swearing, and it's a real nice tune.
Yo,
so check
Dead
it
Prez
out.
Is
Sick
like,
man.
Yeah. Radio Basics, we out.
Peace, Toronto. This traffic jam.
slowing me down. If I could make it off to the freeway,
so much we miss where we going. Situations sometimes get frustrating, but if we won't make it, we got to have patience.
Life is a traffic jam. Life is a traffic jam. Sometimes life is a traffic jam. 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 Sometimes life is a traffic jam. Life is a traffic jam.
So let's jam. Let's jam. Let's jam.
Who's listening? This is Radio.